Blog Talk Radio.
The New Age, the term Celtic. I'll talk about that first before I actually get started on the essay itself, and then this threefold law and tenfold, however many things you want to come up with. Basically, this concept of the New Age term karma, which is a whole lot of crap. Okay, and it. needs to be discussed and brought out. Now, the term Celtic, it's really a modern construction. I know the word is ancient, and it was a word used, I think, mainly by the Romans in reference to the Teutonic peoples, the Germanic peoples in particular. But, you know, it's really Teutonic more than it is Celtic, okay? And so anyway, I'll go ahead and get started here on this. And then afterwards I have some more comments before I finalize the show, and I'll play some more music too. I'm going to say some things here about Wicca, since it was a real since it is real popular, and all it really does mainly is provide a means for severely unpopular women to get naked and dance to drumming around a campfire. Lesbians, gays, and wimpy men in general really seem to be attracted to this for whatever reason as well. Wicca and New Age are the Judeo-Christianized version of witchcraft. One of the major goals of Christianity is to destroy the past and replace it with fictitious versions that conform to the lie of Christianity. Recently, they've been working to turn the religion into a goddess cult by gradually getting rid of the horn gods so there will be fewer and fewer ties with the original religions. Wicca and New Age are both a bogus movement, not based upon the facts, but like Christianity, it is based upon stolen and altered rites and teachings. Like Christianity, it depends upon the ignorance of its followers to thrive. Wicca is simply Satanism light. It is a waste of time and for fools. I will elaborate further by explaining the Wiccan threefold law of return. I want to expose this lie and its origins. The threefold, the tenfold, the hundredfold, however many folds you want to give this, all of these were invented by a few to frighten the masses in order to maintain spiritual control. With the availability of knowledge in modern times, witchcraft could no longer be suppressed, so the oppressors had to find a way to keep it in line so real power and control can remain in the hands of the few. These few know the truth and are adepts in black magic, which they use liberally to spiritually enslave the masses. They control the mainstream religions that are nothing but programs to suppress knowledge and control humanity. The following information exposes this lie for what it is. Now, there's going to be some French in here, and as I've said before, someone from Southeast Texas just ain't going to speak French real well, so I'll try to get through some of this as best I can. The first known reference in print to the threefold law of return appeared in 1970 in a book called Witchcraft, Ancient and Modern by Raymond Buckland, who was initiated into the craft by Gerald Gardner and was instrumental in introducing Gardnerian witchcraft into the United States. With enough research, it is evident that the threefold emerged with the Gardnerian tradition. Then we have the sevenfold, and I'm sure everyone has heard of the tenfold. My point here is none of this recent man-made nonsense has anything to do with the original religions. Its sole purpose is to keep people from using their inborn power and to promote a passive attitude that is accepting of abuse. This is no different from the Christian church. This threefold teaching was taken from the Eastern concept of karma after it emerged with Western Christianity. After the Eastern teachings of karma picked up the Judeo-Christian overtones of divine punishment, the product evolved into yet another system of control with the same theme of keeping power in the hands of a few who know how to use it to exploit humanity. One thing led to another, and Gerald Gardner added more to this and promoted the belief that witches must never use their powers to cause harm. Everyone has to take abuse and keep the passive attitude. The Wiccan read, and it harm none, do what ye will. According to Gardner, the creed is derived from good King Palsal, who declared, "Do what you like so long as you harm no one." King Palsal is a fictitious character from the French novel by Pierre Louis called Les Adventures du Roi Palsal, or something along those lines. In 1901, reprinted in 1925, numerous times since. Or The Adventures of King Palsal, or The Body, Good-Natured Sovereign. This is the basis of Wicca. Wicca is nothing more than a Christianized version of the old religions. Wiccans have taken selected rites and teachings to suit their whims from the original religions and have twisted, corrupted, and transformed them, and are now passing themselves off as the original religion. As I've said before, they like to cut the head off of the original, put theirs on top, and then prance around and act as if theirs is the original and everyone else is a copycat. They do that with everything. The hypocrisy can be readily seen in the gods they acknowledge. Many, if not most, of these gods and goddesses that they claim to worship were the ones who brought the teachings of magic to humans, both white and black magic. They are known as the fallen ones. The original horn god is Satan. In addition, few Wiccans bother to do any in-depth research regarding the gods and goddesses they commune with and worship. Most of these deities are of the satanic pantheon of hell. Many Wiccans and more pagans also unknowingly mix their deities, in other words, angels with demons, and this can spell disaster. You can read a long list of deities these people claim to worship, and it is obvious they really know nothing much about them. Most of the writings consist of nothing but talk. For example, how Ishtar should be invoked instead of Astaroth, even though they are the same exact goddess. They claim using the name Astaroth is different, even though they readily admit she is the same goddess. Go figure. According to author Raymond Buckland, Wiccans claim their religious roots to be evident in a Paleolithic cave painting of a man dressed in stag skins, presumably performing a dance. Caverne de Troyes, I can't read this, is the site of this cave painting somewhere in France, obviously. It is just that, a man dressed up in animal skins, and there literally is no proof of anything. Wicca is a Christianized corruption of the old pagan religions. Wicca is the Judeo-Christianized version of witchcraft. Again, one of the major goals of Christianity is to destroy the past and replace it with fictitious versions that conform to the lie of Christianity. The word Wicca actually comes from the same old English word as witch does. Wicca, meaning to yield or bend, as the Christianized Saxons would have it, to demons, which is a Greek word, daemons, and means gods or intelligences. Again, the original pentagrams pointed to the earth, not up in the air. And when I say again, you have to refer back to some of my previous presentations that I did with Mike. And by the way, I'm going to try to upload those onto my own personal Blog Talk Radio account here pretty soon to make it easier for people to find. So, for all you Wiccans and you New Agers as well, time to seriously get a fucking clue. Okay. This is mainly more about the modern Celtic and New Age here, this portion of it. Any criticism of New Age paganism or Wicca or even so Celtic derives from one simple fact, that being that it is a marketing exercise that is deliberately designed not to work in the way that real witchcraft did and still does. The word Celtic is also used because Gaelic is a bad word in Britain, as they have worked hard to eradicate the influence of their Gaelic culture there. Again, more Romanized than Gaelic. New Age, Wicca, etc. just rehashes old, hypocritical Christian moral values and symbols and attaches to them a host of products, services, and useless books with built-in obsolescence manufactured or written by cynical, unregenerate businessmen to whom any palely glimmering moments of enlightenment that have ever come have been when they have had to change a blown 40-watt bulb and whose livelihoods depend on a captive customer base comprising of a cyclically revolving stream of inadequate, continuously buying the next soul-saving product or idea from them. Modern Wicca, like so much else in the 20th century society, is imitation and hollow mimicry. It is safe and respectable, and consequently, it is dead. If it had any intrinsic psychobiological value, and any consequent potential for making significant social changes, the establishment would have squashed the New Age movement in the first few months of its emergence. Like everything else in the marketplace, however, it is no more than a fashion statement, a lifestyle choice with a price tag attached. Modern Wicca is nothing more than an invented hodgepodge of Anglo-Catholic white middle-class moral attitudes and desires. To wit, it is modern, born-again Christianity dressed up in the Edwardian pseudo-pornographic imagery of titillating young nymphs prancing naked around bonfires in deep dark woods, mixed in copiously with elements of fantasy paganism that could be found anywhere in the neoclassical and ersatz Celtic revivalist guff of the Victorian period. The New Age, Celtic or Wicca, or any other of the myriad of identical merchantable material or mental commodities being offered to fill the deliberately manufactured holes in people's personalities, are any more than pecuniary responses to the manifestation of the individual's social inadequacy. They are created and fueled by corporate greed, the sole inspiration and emotive force behind the new fads and services that emerge to fill gaps in world markets, which were contrived by the establishment's conditioning of its captive consumer workforce to be inadequate in the first place. In Britain, for example, the British Trading Standards Office demands of the manufacturer or service provider that any goods or services offered for sale by them should be fit to be used for the purpose for which they were intended. And where the New Age movement, Wicca, and indeed modern revivalist Christianity are concerned, all fall below this definition, and furthermore, technically fall foul of the British Trades Description Act. All, including revivalist Christianity, need to be investigated in these terms and in relation to the British Fraudulent Mediums Act. They won't be because they make money. They're impotent and harmless as far as the security services are concerned, and they keep the bald pink monkeys quiet in their semi-detached consumer cages. However inadequate and fraudulent these services are in relation to what they claim to be to achieve for people, they are nevertheless adequate and succinct social indicators. The boom in these markets reflects the increasing sense of alienation and the dissatisfaction and disillusionment in traditional values and institutions felt by the consumer. The former two are not real Celtic, not real magic, and not real witchcraft, any more than the latter is the genuine old-time New Testament Christianity that the besuited preachers would have us believe it to be. They are all worst-guessing marketing hype, as are the endless stream of sanitized books. This in itself is a clear indication that they speak not the truth, nor do they stand for truth, but rather the continuity of their own survival and for the maintenance of their power base and their profit margins. If they are prepared to ditch the central concepts of heaven and hell, which they cherished dearly for centuries as a tool for propagating fear with which to control the people, they are capable of any adjustment in the name of mammon. They are pecuniary hypocrites to man. This is not a new age of enlightenment, but simply the old school, the religious, academic, industrial establishment, flogging reconditioned junk in the hope that they can continue to hoodwink the cretinous masses from which they feed like leeches, into staying put and continuing to work subserviently for their sole benefit. The Celtic, Wicca, and New Age movement, like born-again Christianity, is big business worldwide. And if it were actually capable of helping people to achieve what it says they can achieve, it would go bust in a matter of months, along with 90% of the world's manufacturing and service industries, which would also be deemed irrelevant, becoming redundant as people across the globe achieve a sense of personal self-sufficiency, self-sufficient integrity as the planet entered a new age of peace. Under the prevailing social economic conditions, the much-lauded Age of Aquarius can never be the age of the individual who attains integrity and personal sovereignty. It can only be the age of selfish insularity, exacerbated by the ever-increasing pressure upon the consumer slaves of the free West to further cultivate the same old sense of greed and fear, which will in turn goad them into buying more and more in order to assuage the ever-increasing sense of impotence, disenfranchisement, loneliness, and pointlessness that the corporate elites have instilled in them for centuries. To the sociologists who advise governments, we have become categorized into numbered social units. To those governments' military tacticians, we are expendable civilian collateral assets. And to the tradesmen who control these governments, we are consumers. Do we wish to continue to be labeled so cynically and only according to our relative value to any given elite or its agents? You want real Celtic? Learn about the Druids. You want mystical Christianity? Study Crowley. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and play a song, and we'll be wrapping this up shortly. I'll come back with my final comments. Tonight with Pluto making contact with the Galactic Center, which happened in 2006. I have a short essay that I will read probably at the end of the show, like I'm doing right now, next week. And then I also have two articles on Pluto in Capricorn. One of them is fairly short. The other one is just slightly longer. Next week's show will be similar to this. However, one of the people that I will have on, as far as recording goes, will be an astrologer who began with architecture, just like I did. And there will be some more themes along the lines of what we've been discussing the past few shows. So, anyway, we'll go ahead and wrap this up. And I'm sorry, I just can't get to calls. We'll, at some point, we'll dedicate some section of a future show just for calls, okay? So, again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Okay? The truth is hate, only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Odin demands that you grow the fuck up. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. So until next time, hail Satan.
You're in teller.
Satan! Satan! Satan!
Well, that last segment was rather interesting, especially the part about the Black Death. So you can see the value of astrology. The next one I have here is a man who started out in architecture and started getting into other things such as spirituality and essentially the occult. And I highly respect this man, and I think after listening to this you'll find what he has to say rather interesting, although it differs in the sense that he's not really going to be discussing so much the Uranus square Pluto or Pluto in Capricorn or Neptune in Pisces, etc. It's just basically astrology, the occult, spirituality in general, mixed with astrology, etc. And I think you will all enjoy this. This show does not have to be just about these transits that I've been talking about so far. And so, by the way, like I said, that Robert Hand piece, it was clear that was before the 2008 elections. At that time, Saturn had moved into to Libra, and Saturn spends about 2.5 years in each sign, and Saturn has moved into Scorpio now. So, but what happened was it set off what's called a T-square. You had a Saturn opposition Uranus, because you had Saturn at zero Libra, then you had Uranus at zero Aries. Those two signs are opposite. And the midpoint of that was Pluto at Capricorn. And they were all on with cardinal signs, which represent the beginning of the seasons. So anyway, this is A.T. Mann, and he is also an author of many books. So without further ado.
Interested in architecture, and that in turn came from a tremendous early love of trees. And it was fascinating because when I was a young kid, I had very unusual circumstances. My father died in the war before I was born, and so I always have this, when I look back at pictures of myself at that time, I look quite lost. But I used to climb up into the trees, and I used to notice the stars passing over the branches of trees out through the canopy. And I used to think to myself, I wonder if these branches connect these stars to each other. And I loved architecture from an early age without knowing an architect and really without knowing what it is. And so I went to architecture school at Cornell and went to New York and worked as an architect, as I did in Rome. And while I was in Rome, I began to really start resonating with not just 16th century architecture, Palladio and Brunelleschi and Michelangelo, but I began getting interested in the history, more deeper history of Italy and so on. And I felt a kind of limitation arising in the architecture, that architecture is about space, and it's taught that way in colleges. At that point, I went to Cornell University. And to me, it seemed very static and not very interesting. And I began to feel more and more interested in proportion systems, but also in how you move through a building. And the way you move through a building involves a time coordinate. And I felt that certain spaces of certain shapes, I was curious why they evoke particular feelings, particular images. And this really awakened an interest in astrology, which when I first came across it, I wasn't wildly impressed because of the people that I talked to about it, but I began to realize that it was actually a fourth dimensional pursuit of architecture, and that a horoscope could potentially be a four-dimensional structure of one's life through time. And this is something I've written about a lot in my Sacred Architecture book, simply because one of my more interesting usual theories is that is actually an answer to this question about the fact that the base chakra is always symbolized as a cube. So spaces that are perfect cubes resonate with the base chakra, in the same way that domes are often associated with throat chakra, and crown type spaces are associated with crown chakra. Triangular spaces, and in fact even proportions that are based on triangles, evoke heart chakra. So the proportions of spaces that you're in quite literally resonate with some part of your nature. And it gradually morphed, because when I came to it, I'd already read Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and Rodney Cullen extensively. And they came from a kind of Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and a tradition that was actually integrating Eastern knowledge and bringing it to the West, together with very profound Sufi ideas about perception. And I was very much engaged in the Gurdjieff work when I came to astrology, so I noticed immediately that the way the horoscope was presented was extremely static. And I just decided to make some drawings to find out how it really worked. And in the process, I developed a Rodney Cullen idea a bit further. And that idea is about the spiraling solar system. And the fact is that the sun actually moves around the galactic center, and this is very relevant to the 2012, although no one talks about it. Our sun moves around the galactic center. In fact, it probably moves around the star Sirius, which moves around the galactic center. So we revolve around Sirius, which in turn revolves around the galactic center. Well, the rate at which the sun moves is 500,000 miles a day, 500,000 miles a day, which means the sun is moving at 20,000 miles an hour, and it's carrying the planets along with it. And when you represent this, it's a series of very complex spirals with a filament of the sun in the middle. And Mercury is a little tiny yellow one, and Venus is a green one, and Mars, you know, in the Earth is a blue one. And therefore, it gives you a whole dynamic sense of how the sun moves through time, followed by the planets. You know, the Earth itself is 90 million miles from the sun, and it moves a million miles a day around the sun. So we're actually moving at close to the speed of a bullet. And with this perspective, it means that a birth horoscope is simply a slice through this spiral. And in reality, it means obviously that you can extend it forward into the future and backward into the past. And so I developed a way of astrology that I call lifetime astrology, because I use this Gurdjieff and Ouspensky scale going back to conception. And I start when the parents make love to conceive a child. And this is a prototype of your sexuality, of your integration of anima and animus in a psychological sense, your path of spiritual discovery and so on. And because you include this gestation period, the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th houses, it means that basically you must understand your mother and return to the realm of the mothers. And this provoked a whole other set of processes, so that gestation is like the collective unconscious, because we relive the entire evolutionary process in the womb, and planets that register there are literally stored somatically. They're stored in your body. And this corresponds to a lot of Ken Wilber's work, for example, where, you know, there are chironic levels of reality. Well, in gestation, the ninth house is always called higher mind, for example. And in reality, in the first 7 weeks, we're basically a brain attached to a little vestigial skeletal system, and we emerge from the animal state into human state in that period of time, which is symbolized by a centaur, which is a half, you know, a horse's body and a human torso aspiring to the sky. So it's interesting, because the stages of gestation are not only psychological states, but I began making them compare to biological states. So books of mine have ranged from how to use a technique like this to Astrology and the Art of Healing, which explores the fact that you're really talking about, you know, psychology doesn't exist on its own without a biology. We need a body. And similarly, the idea of the spiraling solar system is that I discovered in going back to conception that certain horoscopes seem to indicate something in the eighth house before that. And that evolved into a lot of reincarnation work, where basically you can track that spiraling solar system. But the main analogy is that the solar system moving through time, from the Earth's point of view, is a double helix, and that the structure of the moving solar system is identical to the DNA molecule. So to use the metaphor of as above, so below, in this case, it's a literal connection, because the mathematics, the structure, the form of DNA is exactly parallel to the spiraling solar system. In my postulate, basically, is that we resonate naturally in the microcosm of every cell with the macrocosmic movement of the spiraling solar system, and that when you're in touch, when you're connected, when you're grounded, when you have access to the spiritual, you can tap in to the mind, to the collective intelligence in each cell. And of course, because it goes back to creation, it tracks back through the mitochondrial DNA, that a woman's ovum, the women's ova that are produced in her entire lifetime are there not long after conception. And in fact, that ovum is really the ovum from which they were conceived. So effectively, a woman's initial ovum, her kind of ur ovum, is in fact comes from her mother, which comes from her mother, which comes from her mother. So the ovum is in fact eternal.
I'm going to interject something here. If any of you have been following along with Santos's work on astrology, and again, I don't recommend that guy personally. If you just pay attention to his work on astrology and astrotheology and disregard most of the rest, some of the rest is okay. And of course, I think there's a question about this guy's integrity on other issues, but that's a personal opinion of some people. And you'll discover that basically the sun is the sun. The father is Sirius. Now, the Holy Spirit is the rays of the sun, and the rays of the sun purify. Too much of them will give you a sunburn. So there you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay, with that explained, we'll move on.
And you can track it back through time and space. And this explains things that have no apparent physical vehicle, like Edgar Cayce's, the Akashic Record, which, of course, everyone thinks about as being some area up here somewhere, you know. But the Akashic Record is available in every cell. And Jung's collective unconscious, similarly, is a record of that historical process. And when you take some certain substances, what's interesting is that hallucinogenic drugs and plants very often accelerate your metabolism. And when that happens, you travel back in age. because each age of your life is attached to a particular molecular level of speed. And when your metabolism expands beyond a certain speed, you go back through childhood. Hence, the horizon comes much, much closer. Smaller, closer objects become objects of amazing beauty and complexity. And then at a certain point, you go faster than your birth moment, and you enter a pre-uterine world. And in that world, you have no visual concept, so you see swirling lights. And in fact, you travel back through history. So I've developed this kind of postulate in a number of ways, and many astrologers around the world have been using it. I mean, it's, you know, I've written 20 books, but about six of them are about astrology. So yes, I wrote a book called The Divine Plot in the 80s that's about reincarnation, astrology, cosmology, history. And that's a linear movement, the precession of the equinoxes, creating that complete cycle that always links back to the galactic center. It's very much like in the lifetime, that we're still living under a kind of Galilean and Euclidean logic, which says that every year is the same because it's the same length. But in reality, in our life, time compacts as we age. It moves faster. It accelerates. What I believe is happening is that there's an acceleration occurring right now on this planet, and that it's an acceleration of consciousness just as it's an acceleration of population. And indeed, it's a very interesting idea in many ways, because it reaches a certain point where we will flip out into a whole different dimension. This is an idea I've held, you know, since the beginning. And of course, it corresponds with a 2012 dynamic and so on. And it's very, very interesting. It's like the mechanist chose to take a kind of I Ching metaphor in terms of measuring this process, but a logarithmic scale, which I also use. And this comes from the Colin Ouspensky work, that it's a spiral process and that our time develops in life exponentially. In fact, at conception, it's molecular, and then it becomes cellular as we are conceived and our body is created, and then at death, of course, the whole process dissipates. We disassemble, in fact, the four bodies, and that soul that's liberated at death, you know, in the Ouspensky idea, of course, travels into infinity in that moment, or eternity, and returns to a new womb. So it's very interesting, because my way of doing astrology, it's fascinating because it not only comes from spiritual traditions that are very Eastern, but it also actually has this connection to biology. I just recently came across some amazing work by a physicist called Garrett Lisi, something called E8. And you can see it on YouTube by just searching on these names. But it basically is a mandala pattern, like mandalas I've been painting since the late 60s, early 70s, except it's a theory that includes all of the modern kind of primary particles, but also gravity. And it's so mandalic, it's so astrological, it's so tuned into certain images that I've been making for years, that it's very interesting. I see a lot of this coalescing, and I think both 2012 and the Uranus-Pluto square evoke these kinds of ideas. What happens is that when the planets move through time and space, and this is the Colin analogy, when they move through time and space, they leave an electronic pattern. And, of course, that electronic pattern, via resonance, you know, resonance is a communication method that's not based on traveling through time and or space, but rather it's an instantaneous transmission of information. So any two things in the universe, no matter how far apart they are, that have the same structure, resonate. When you see someone you connect with immediately across the room, there's a resonance between the energy pattern you carry and the energy pattern they carry. And this information is transmitted. So when we have planetary events, for example, everyone's resonating with it. Very few are really knowing where that resonance derives from. And astrology is simply a way of, within my metaphor, not only of decoding DNA, but it's also a way of decoding these kind of planetary signals that we're continually receiving. And it it becomes really, I think, quite a powerful and interesting metaphor to actually explore. Yeah, well, we carry many beings within ourselves in the sense that once there's a gate that exists at around the conception point, which in astrology is the ninth cusp, and the eighth house is death and the end of life, and the ninth house is conception and rebirth and so on. And as the Tibetan Buddhists believe, and Hindus and many, many other sects, that once those kind of gateways and barriers are penetrated through an initiation of some kind, there are many ways to achieve that, but once that barrier is broken, you have access through the DNA spiral to time and space. Similarly, you could say in a way that it's access to the galactic core. You know, and this is kind of intriguing because the implication is that, well, there are a number of implications. One of them that's very interesting is that the DNA molecule has been decoded. We all know this. But what we don't know is that they've decoded 1% of the DNA molecule. They consider the other 99% junk DNA. And I believe the junk DNA is really the repository of the Akashic record, the collective unconscious, and that it represents traces of all history. And in fact, not just back to the first life on this planet, but because of the nature of it, it actually goes back into a kind of mineral level of reality. This is all Rodney Collin work, and that basically there are a series of cycles within cycles. And Collin said, you know, the cycles go from moon to earth to sun and solar system to galaxy, but there was a space between the galactic center and Earth and the sun, and Collin figured out mathematically that the missing component was exactly the same time and or distance away as the planet Sirius. So, and the Egyptians, as you probably know, considered Sirius to be the sun of our sun. So the interesting thing is that I gave a talk on this at CIIS. Rick Tarnas invited me a few years ago, and I got the faculty in a total uproar by talking about this because the scientific mind finds it very difficult to kind of understand this kind of logic. But the drift of it is really quite fascinating, that we have access to this junk DNA, which is all history, but once you access it, and people access it who are psychotic or are spiritual and mediumistic and people who are able to break down those barriers through various chemicals, drugs, dances, music, trance, all kinds of things. So believe that that we are part of this kind of galactic universe, and that this alignment, particularly the engagement of Sirius into the equation, brings a whole other dimension to it. And that I think that at that alignment, ideas like I'm just describing are ironically becoming closer and closer to the cutting edge of physics and science. When I went to Cornell as an undergraduate in architecture, not only was Nabokov teaching there, but also Niels Bohr was teaching there. And he produced a program that we were required to take as architects, which was quantum mechanics and relativity without calculus. So it's a kind of schematic physics. So I've kept up with it since then. And, you know, it's kind of interesting as an astrologer to have a background in architecture and mathematics and physics, that it creates something very, very different. And so this dynamic of time, to me, is something quite extraordinary. In the Divine Plot, I actually produced a scheme of that 20 years ago, and basically I said that, you know, the octave of a person's life resonates with the next larger octave, which is a world age of 50,000 years, you know, around the time that the transition between Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon happened around 50,000 years ago. And once again, it's like humanity just arose. We aren't genetically connected to Neanderthal. There's really no precedent for us.
Or the brain.
And in the same way, if you study actually about scientific work about DNA, they've discovered DNA from a billion years ago on this planet, and it's identical in structure to DNA today. So my feeling is, and no one knows where DNA came from, but I think it's quite fascinating that it really does, if it's a mirror image at some micro level of the movement of the solar system through time, then it's gradually mutating, of course, as it is. But what it means basically is that it's almost like a vehicle that comes into being that then takes raw material available on a planet and transcends by creating a series of forms that become finer and finer until they can gradually migrate. And I think we're at a stage where this migration may be closer in terms of time travel, for example, than anything else. The Scarlatti idea is terrific because it looks like a time machine, which is the way I've seen mandalas, which is the way I see all of this. And Colin and Uspensky talk about this, and I've been doing a lot of Tibetan Buddhist work and meditation in recent years, and it synchronizes with that dynamic completely. Two years ago, I went to see the Thai Sithu Rinpoche, who's the head of the Red Hat sect. I went to his monastery, Sherab Ling, which is right near the Tibetan border in North India. It's actually north of Nepal. And I had a connection through a common friend, and I spent, you know, normally if you get an audience of 2 minutes with him, it's great. I spent 4 hours with him on two successive days because he's, you know, each of the four major lineages, the red hat, the green, the yellow, and the black, the Karmapa's right near here, you know, in Boulder next weekend, that the Thai Sithu, who we just hit it off immediately, that his sect of Buddhism in his previous incarnations have specialized in architecture, mandala painting, and astrology. And they create the Buddhist, yearly almanacs, in the calendar. I've spent the last 35 years doing calendars most years. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, at one stage, very much like 2012, I really believe that there's a kind of an accumulation of energy and that it's moving towards this kind of molecular level. I mean, the way computers work is part of it, of course. But, I mean, this kind of digital world is getting closer and closer. Well, there are a couple of things. One of them is that I had a Pluto squaring my sun around 1998-99, and my life completely died and was reborn, and including my Danish wife. And it was a tremendously traumatic time, and I felt, I'm very Plutonic to begin with, but I felt really drawn into the underworld, and I felt invisible. I was living in Denmark, I didn't speak the language, and my wife was very, very ill, and it was a real crisis time. And a friend of mine who's here at this conference, Brian Clark, who lives in Melbourne, took me aside at one point at one of the previous UACs, and he said, do you know, because he's a mythologist, he said, do you know that Pluto, being the god of the underworld, can't go above ground? And when he does, mortals can't see him because he wears a band of invisibility. And so he said, you're wearing a band of invisibility because you're approaching this Pluto connection. So it's a very interesting metaphor, but of course I also realized in a seminar the other day here that when Pluto gets downgraded so that it's not considered a planet, that means it's become invisible, and that means by extension it's approaching the conscious domain. So Pluto is coming above ground, out of the underworld, into the upper world, wearing his band of invisibility. And I happen to think this is a terrific metaphor for what we're experiencing at this moment and what we in turn will experience, because Pluto is you know, it's rebirth at the cost of death, and that it represents a time of tremendous chaos and travail. And you know, of course, only speaking for myself, I'm very Plutonic because I was born in the war and my father was a soldier, you know, an Air Force pilot bombing Germany. And, you know, and it that's very, very powerful. And it feels in a way like a synthesis of these kinds of qualities. Uranus is another issue because it's profoundly different in many ways, although, of course, it's Promethean, and it has to do also with access to the gods, so it's not surprising that you see kind of major trends in contemporary astrology that are trying to mythologize astrology effectively. And, of course, this is great, and I support it, but I also don't believe that psychology exists, you know, independent of the body. Talking to some mythologists, you'd think that it was. But Uranus is very, very different because Uranus represents rhythm. In fact, it represents spirals. It represents the kind of dynamics and pattern work that I'm talking about here, and about the idea of resonance, and about the idea of decoding information. I think that discovering more about genetics comes through, but they're beginning to realize that the junk DNA, apparently there are hugely long stretches of what look like apparently random patterns in the DNA that are identical, not only from one human to another, but this other kind of unique quality, which is that every life form on this planet has DNA which is 99.8% similar to ours. So every living being has the same genetic pattern. And, of course, if you think about it, that's the only reason we can eat them and retain sustenance. So, you know, one of my kind of wackier theories, which I quite like, is that when you eat something, you're eating a form of DNA that's way prior to human existence, unless you're cannibalistic. But, you know, things like water is probably the purest thing you can drink because it goes back the furthest. Something like, you know, the early vegetables or algae are tremendously empowering in a certain way because algae were among the first life forms. So you're actually introducing into your system something that's just immensely old and therefore is kind of beyond the realm of the pollution that happens through and complexity that happens through time.
Okay, there are two more segments of this guy. Each one is just under 10 minutes. They're about 9 minutes, 40 seconds long. So this is definitely going to go into the archives. I don't know how much time yet I'm going to spend in the archives. I'm going to get ready to do the show on Satanism on my Blog Talk account afterwards. And again, you can check back on Renegade, and that will be added to the show list here for me and on the main page. And so anyway, let's go ahead and start listening to this. And again, I apologize for going into the archives, but in my opinion, most of this information is just too important. And I think most people here will benefit from hearing this guy. Again, I think this guy is really awesome. So anyway, here we go.
Again, that phrase, you know, you are what you eat, takes on a very, very different flavor. And, you know, similarly, the postulate of my work, you know, as above, so below, to me means something very different because I'm saying as above in the spiral solar system that surrounds us, so below in the DNA molecule in every cell, and that astrology is a way of decoding genetics and that it's a kind of spiritual but also geometric language. And nature programs things by imagery. And, you know, as Rupert Sheldrake, friend of mine, kind of talks about all the time, it's really quite powerful stuff. So I think when these two planets go square to each other, And again, like probably everything else, my take on squares are very different, because in a circle, I see a square as, rather than just a line of two planets 90 degrees apart, for me, it's a square. And that when a square aspect happens, because I see that the chart is moving, that when a square happens, it forces you to go into the center of your being and to change directions 90 degrees to get back out to the periphery. So a square is a profound change of direction. And hence, it tends to be interpreted as, unless you choose to change, you then become forced to change. And you don't really get to vote either way, but you do get to either be proactive with this dynamic and to utilize it in some form, or resisting it at the cost, usually, of quite serious illness, if not death. So I think Uranus Pluto is leading us to a place that's very similar to this, meaning that it's not just a kind of psychological crisis, but it's an environmental crisis, and it's a genetic crisis with the DNA tampering. I mean, I don't like that at all. And I was in Bali last November, and it's kind of very prosaic looking out over the rice fields, and it's very, very beautiful, until you meet some of the farmers who told me basically that they've been using genetically modified rice for the last 5 years because they get four crops a year instead of three. And so a lot of this very pure lifestyle has already been subjugated by, you know, Monsanto or something. So I really do think that the crisis is one where, if you think about it, this kind of idea or this kind of theory that my work kind of takes me in addresses issues like the fact that, for various reasons, that the sperm count of young men around the world is declining so precariously that we may not be able to breed before long. You know, it's literally down into the 20-30% instead of 70-80% when we were teenagers, you know. So I think that my feeling, of course, is that Gaia, the Earth entity, the Earth consciousness, is in a way bringing this about. And we bring it about, but it's brought about by any society. I don't think it's the first time it's happened either. I believe in eternal recurrence and the repetition of time and history, you know, as the McKennas did. And I'm not saying that because I think it's an interesting idea, but rather because certain experiences I've had over the years, as well as this lifetime of work, points me inescapably in that direction. And I think what's intriguing is that some of us are aware of this and therefore may potentially be able to make this transition to the next, for lack of a better word, the next dimension that we're accessing. And Uranus is, of course, also electronic. So this amazing storage of information, which is happening right now, is I think, quite astonishing in a way. Years ago, writing a book was just an arduous process because of the necessity to actually have the physical object in your hand. And nowadays, no matter where I live, I mean, I have this gigantic library at my disposal. Mind you, most of the books that interest me the most are not ones that have been kind of scanned and made into PDFs, but you know, you never know, that kind of thing can shift. But I think we're heading to a place where, I think, first of all, the Earth needs it. And I think of it as a kind of cleansing process. And that I think the seed of it was sown in the 60s, you know, during that conjunction. And I think that it really does bring up very powerful issues, and I'm trying to address them in various ways in new work. I'm writing a book called Sacred Landscapes right at the moment, and it's about these ideas that when you say that like a churchyard is sacred, which the Roman Catholic Church did by taking pagan sites, you know, Earth Mother cult sites, and suddenly saying this is a sacred site, it implies that everything around it isn't. So it desacralizes nature. And so my books try to address, like sacred architecture, they're profoundly astrological in the sense that that informs them, but I don't mention astrology particularly in them, just to access a larger audience. But you know, this kind of logic is profound, and it's a tool that, you know, I mean, in the Renaissance and in medieval times, significant individuals knew it. It was just part of their language. And I think this way of looking at things is very, very interesting. Again, once you free the solar system from the flat Galilean Euclidean world and suddenly make it three-dimensional. And I gave a talk the other day about Tibetan Buddhism and Western astrology, and it's all about the fact that, you know, principles of Buddhism are integral to the way I do astrology. It may not be others, about impermanence and the fact that it's all changing. And that many astrologers are trying to define people and find the process of which words do you use to define someone. And I love to see it liberated from that, you know, into a state of continual flux and change, because that's where we're headed. Resonance. I mean, I don't know about you, but I love cooking, for example, and I cook very pure foods, you know, the one purest that I can get. And I know that you're transmitting a very particular energy by the way you cook food, you know, and that when you're sensitive to it, there's a huge transmission of information. It is. It's totally alchemy. And I think all of these things seem to be pointing in the same direction to me, you know, and I don't think there's any answer to it. I don't think we can really know it per se, but I do think that the transition is in process as we speak, and that it does represent a really huge catharsis for us as individuals, but also for the society. Well, I don't think it's so different than the preparation that a Tibetan Buddhism would tell you to adopt before you're about to die, which is that you are going to be leaving everything behind. And, you know, in Jung's parlance, Jung said, which I think was very, very perceptive as much of what he said, but he said that, for example, when you study the stars, you're at a certain stage when you begin astrology, you're receiving information as you learn what the stars correspond to. But at a certain point, it begins to become an organizational system. And I happen to use it as a way of organizing my mind. And I naturally categorize things according to their astrological qualities. And this is something that's been going on for thousands of years. But I happen to think, and I agree with Jung, that when this process reverses itself, that in a sense you're projecting your reality into the stars, and that your next incarnation will recognize it at an earlier time than this one did. You know, so if it took me 29 or 30 years that my Saturn cycle to find it this time, maybe the next time it will be earlier. But I think in a way it's kind of transmitting this picture of the world, which I see as being at the core of many of the religions and many philosophies, and at the core they're all very, very similar in this way. I think that how will cultures survive if, for example, one day an asteroid passes by the Earth and zaps every magnetic memory that exists? Computers, no film, no digital apparatus of any kind, because they're all built with magnets. That this, to me, is something that's very, very reasonable, and I think what would happen would be quite extraordinary. I think it would be like a death and rebirth, like a beginning of a new world age. And in that sense, you know, I was drawn to radionics 35 years ago and knew and hung out with some of the primary practitioners of the world. And what attracted me about it is that you have a complete healing system based on energy and on pattern. And I can recreate a remedy by having a piece of paper and a pendulum and a glass of water. And you can literally evoke the vibration of the remedy. And I have a system at home that allows me to do that. So to get around the issue of the fact that everything is polluted now, you know, the plants from which homeopathic remedies are made have, you know, planetary pollutants that essentially make them a lot more toxic than they really should be. But I think I wouldn't at this point know how to begin to create some kind of healing if there were no remedies left and one had to really recreate it. I mean, I don't know anyone who would know how to make a homeopathic remedy. I understand the principle. But I think some of these things are very interesting. Something like homeopathy could be world medicine, or radionics could be a kind of world medicine after things kind of settle down. But I don't want to be kind of a serious pessimist about everything, because in reality, I think it's a kind of natural and inevitable process, like death is. I do want to experience it, you know. I want to go there, and a lot of people are moving at this from different directions. You know, I like Graham Hancock's work, and I'm astonished that he knows zero about astrology. You know, I think someone who claims to have access to these mystery traditions and doesn't know the primary language of that, I mean, it's kind of curious to me. It's okay, of course, but it just is very different. Doing his business in that sense, and particularly moving into Capricorn, which is the sign of the ego. And it's as though we're going to experience the kind of, not necessarily the collapse, but the, in some ways, the death of a certain conception of ego that's happened throughout our history, basically, and that I don't really know what will replace it, but I do know that there will be a death and there will also be a rebirth. It's fascinating, of course, that it seems to correspond to certain events on this planet and also with this alignment to the galactic center. I've always been curious about, you know, the Mayans, for example, and I think that Uranus itself is a technological component, and that technology in a very interesting way is very much like in Tibetan Buddhism. They say that when you die, that you basically forget. And the Greeks said that you pass through or over the river Lethe, which is the river of forgetting. When information resides on computers, we tend to not remember it. And instead of memorizing things at school, you put them on a computer. And the whole, I mean, of course, in certain ways, that's an interesting phenomenon. But what it also creates is a situation where people just literally don't have the kind of structural background that we have, in fact, in the same way that children grow up, instead of being chucked out the back door when you get home from school and showing up 4 hours later. That doesn't happen anymore. So I think there's a kind of mass forgetting going on. I think the presence of television, computers, digital games, video games, and so on, although I use them all and I love using them, at the same time, I think they're a vehicle of forgetting. And to me, that means that we're in a kind of Bardo state right now. In my way of looking at astrology, that death and conception point on the ninth cusp is the first stages of gestation is a kind of Bardo state, which is, in fact, a recreation of the world. You know, the William Blake phrase, I think it is, that, you know, when you're born, you recapitulate the beginning of time. And when you die, it's the end of time. And I believe in some ways that this mass forgetting that's going on right now is something like a kind of planetary Alzheimer's. And that, I think this to me represents a prelude to a very different world. And very much like Pluto surfacing into the conscious realm, that I think that we see a lot of these old languages coming back. It's like an eternal recurrence and a death memory, you know, that at the moment you die, your life passes before you in a fraction of a second. Something happens like that on a planetary level. In fact, the time between 1950 and 2012, it's a very interesting fact, that there will be as many people alive as have lived in the previous 50,000 years. So in a way, all of the souls who have been collected through this 50,000 years of history are here now waiting to experience a kind of collective death point in 2012. Or shortly thereafter. And I don't necessarily think it's going to happen on December 13th, 2012, but I do think that, you know, there are certainly many signs that this kind of dynamic is at work. So I do think that. It's like I think the genetic modification of plants is what they modify is they can't breed. The thing with the bees is part of that. It's, you know, it's like suddenly if there's, you know, the point is these genetically modified crops are beginning to cross-pollinate. And the combination of that with the bees is a metaphor or a parallel to the lowering sperm count in men and the increasing difficulty in women. And it's because our environment is hormone-saturated, you know, with plastics, with, you know, birth control pills that are synthetic and don't break down naturally. They go into the water system, they permeate. You know, you probably saw that information recently that something like 70% of the drinking water in the U.S. has hormones in it and remains of pharmaceuticals. I mean, you know, this. All of these things point to something very similar to me, which is a real culling of the human population in some way. And I just hope that we can come back from that. I was very friendly with a very wonderful man called Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan from the early 70s. I did astrology for their family in Geneva, and he was very active. He was High Commissioner of Refugees of the UN for a number of years, but also ran something called Alp Action. It was a kind of environmental charity foundation. And I remember him meeting with Stuart Brand in the late 70s, and they were saying basically these are a group of men who are, and I think the founder of Greenpeace and various other things, and they were already saying in those days that if carbon processing stopped then, it would be too late. So I think we've reached a point where the weather is really going to, it's huge. That's why I quite like where I live in a funny way, because it's on a river, it's away. We're surrounded by forests for 40, 50 miles. And and I'm almost within walking distance of a biodynamic farm, you know, that is totally self-contained. And I think things like that are going to come back. So, I mean, it's funny and kind of ironic in a way, but things like the health food industry that's kind of cultivated the idea of biological, biodynamic, organic foods and so on is going to be the only stream which will survive. I find... You know, this hotel is a very nice one, but I find it quite toxic in terms of the food, the air, the substance the beds are made out of. I mean, I could be just seen as a pain in the ass, but you know, I'm worried about the prevalence of the toxicity, and you know, I fight to just kind of neutralize it.
Interesting perspectives on a lot of different subjects. He might would make a good Satanist if he could just be enlightened on the topic one day. I'm in contact with some other astrologers, as I mentioned before, one who lives in the Far East, and he sent me something here. I'm not going to read it, but some people who are heavily into the mundane astrology or the political astrology in particular, if you want to be more precise, have suggested that some of the things that they've been looked into, you know, like the timing of the bombing in Boston, you know, as well as some other issues, and then this explosion here in Texas in the town of West, just north of Waco. They are suggesting, in their opinion, and I don't want to take on their opinion, that May 9th may have some sort of significance. And so I just thought I would mention that. Now, I've also mentioned before that I had a couple of articles about Pluto into Capricorn. One of them, you know, neither ones are long. One of them's a little shorter than the other. And then also Pluto in contact with the galactic center, which occurred right before Pluto went into Capricorn. And I'm not going to read all of them, but I am going to read one of them, and then we'll call it quits for this evening. And this one is called Pluto in Capricorn, and this was written in January of 2008. Now, this is by the same guy that Kyle read out of on his show that where we were discussing race mixing. What I would like everyone to do when they hear this is to read between the lines. This guy does not know a lot of the things that we do, or if he did, if he does now, he didn't then, put it that way. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and read this to you. And again, read between the lines. Pluto in Capricorn, written January 25th, 2008. Societal patterns can be observed through the outer planetary transits and planetary ingresses into new signs always bring about new themes. When Pluto changes zodiacal signs, it relates to broad changes on a collective soul level and some of the deepest needs for evolution that can be observed. Pluto takes 248 years to go around the zodiacal wheel, ranging from 1 to 3 decades in each sign due to its elliptical orbit around the sun. The most recent Pluto and Capricorn cycles were 1762 to 1777, which was basically the time of the American Revolution. Also in 1515 through 1532, and in 1296 and 1286. The United States birth chart has Pluto in Capricorn, and it will have its first Pluto return in around 2020, depending on how you want to measure the effects of it. In evolutionary astrology, Pluto represents the soul, both on an individual and collective basis. Pluto through the signs will represent generational growth, while Pluto in a birth chart by house, sign, and aspect will show the individual soul nature, especially where the soul is coming from via past lives. Pluto transits bring opportunities for soul growth on deep personal levels and collective societal groups. Pluto moves into Capricorn on January 25, 2008, and then retreats back into Sagittarius for one last time from June 13 to November 26, 2008, when it enters Capricorn again for the next 15 years. Pluto moves back and forth between Capricorn and Aquarius for 2 years in 2023 and through 2024 when it finishes up these Pluto and Capricorn lessons. For now, in 2008, it will be a major transitional year with Pluto archetypes, and it is also 1 year of new beginnings in numerology. Sagittarian ideals will now be replaced with Capricorn practicalities. This is a year of conserving and releasing Sagittarius fluff. Show me the money. Pluto in Capricorn is interested in power, achieving it, and keeping it. For some, the end may justify the means. Those who have been in power, like the military-industrial complex, will not willingly release their control. The people as a group will need to claim their power back. Pluto in Capricorn. Capricorn, ruled by Saturn, is an earth sign related to the physical world. It is known for career and the father archetype, conformity and control. On psychological levels, it is about self-determination and self-responsibility. It is about social maturation and fulfilling our functions in the community. The days of easy credit are over, and the realities of making ends meet will now take on new and sometimes frightening meanings. Jupiter in Capricorn, Jupiter in Capricorn, December 18th, 2007 through January 5th, 2009 will emphasize the get real themes. Now, I'll also look back in time here. This is me interjecting. When the market crash occurred in 2008. Now, that was in roughly fall 2008. And so he had written this before that time, so that ought to tell you something there too. Now, Sagittarius, ruled by Jupiter, relates to natural laws and principles, which is about living in harmony in nature. Global warming, which is bullshit, or our human influence on nature, became a household word through Pluto and Sagittarius. Now the effects of having dominion, control over nature will come forth through Pluto in Capricorn. Human consciousness may think it has the upper hand, yet nature will now force us to get real as resource scarcity under the current economic paradigms no longer work. World oil supplies could peak and start to deplete through Pluto in Capricorn. Bullshit. Forcing collective resource changes on mega levels. The current financial and economic structures will no longer work as they have done in the past. What did I say earlier? Whether westernized humanity collapses or reinvents itself will be our free choice. The early phases of the last Uranus-Neptune synod, initiated with their 1993 conjunctions at 18 to 20 degrees Capricorn, offer hope through their transits in Aquarius and Pisces. yet changes on the collective level tend to come through necessity versus choice. Now, in 1993, I'm interjecting here, there was a conjunction of Uranus and Neptune at 18 to 20 degrees Capricorn. Now, before Pluto leaves Capricorn, it will conjunct that conjunction point. So I think that is a critical stage. I didn't look up the time when that occurs, but just keep that in mind for future reference. Okay, Capricorn relates to the need to be secure, to be consistent in order to feel a sense of control. It creates crystallization. Even though it is cardinal, an initiating sign, like the seasons, the beginning of the seasons, it is a physical earth sign. So changes tend to be those that reinforce a sense of security or projecting the past forward. It takes an archetype like Pluto with its death and rebirth energy to rock the boat and create the necessary metamorphosis, whatever that may be. We have forgotten the natural Sagittarius archetype of our interconnectedness to nature. We have forgotten natural spiritual laws and principles. The last Pluto and Sagittarius transit saw the rise, and in some places the fall, of another wave of religious fundamentalism. Realignments with nature and natural laws are still necessary. Expansions are balanced out of contractions. Sagittarius to Capricorn, the element fire to earth. And of course, Pluto was in Sagittarius before he moved into Capricorn. As Pluto and Jupiter begin their travels through Capricorn, and of course, Jupiter has moved on into Gemini, review your own personal resources and goals. Is your financial net worth in the black or red? Now, that was nice advice back in early 2008, wasn't it? How can you deduce your debts? How can you reduce your debts? Sorry. Can you save money? Can you set aside a percentage of your income for future needs and retirement? Can you say no to material goods until you have the cash to pay for them? Reducing credit will allow for more financial flexibility whenever future changes are necessary. Search for the ways you can create more inner security. This will address the real security needs we have when world changes are upon us. What was Eric's advice? The polarity of Capricorn is Cancer. When the outer world confounds us, the answers are found inward. Capricorn wants to control from the outward in, and lessons are to do the opposite. Now, I'm going to interject something here. One of the things about astrology that you learn fairly quickly is the need to incorporate the qualities of the opposite sign. Become as responsible as you can for your own needs, both inner and outer. Review the values and goals that are most important to you, then set steps in place to achieve them. No excuses. Strive for self-responsibility and self-determination. While Pluto and Capricorn may bring extreme crises for many souls, those aligning with more natural laws can flourish, even become the beacons of light. Another Capricorn lesson is to learn how to be in the world rather than of the world. Saturnian conformity must be balanced with individual growth. Both have a place to function in a communal sense. The more self-responsible we are, the more freedoms we have, and the less burdens we create in any relations. Then visualize the world as you desire to see it. Be your example in the world. Healthy Pluto in Capricorn takes care of the community and its children. It honors family. Pressure to conform to traditional gender roles is addressed by balancing both our masculine and feminine sides in all of our souls. Women who are self-responsible and men who care. Taking care of the children will be a recurring Pluto in Capricorn theme. It takes a lot less resources to raise healthy children than to repair wounded adults. I think that is rather interesting. Now, again, read between the lines. And by the way, I hope everybody had a chance to listen to the end of my last show where I read the essay that I culled together for the word Celtic, New Age, Wicca, the threefold law, tenfold law, hundredfold law, sevenfold law, whatever law you want to try to conjure up. And if you didn't, I think it'd be great if you went back to that show and listened to it. I'm going to go ahead and close this show out. Let me get back to my notes here. And again, I'll send out all these links. And I think what I'm going to do, the last few essays that I have here on this topic, I will incorporate into a later show into the future. You know, maybe one of the shows that I do where I discuss different topics. Hold on just 1 second. I need to cough. Okay, so in closing, so again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? I'll close with these final thoughts. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want your guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal. Equal men aren't free. Odin demands that you grow the fuck up. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. Let me get back to the studio and I'll play a song. Which one do I want to play? Let's see here. Here's a good one. Drinks.
Only women bleed. Only women bleed.
Teller.
Satan! Satan!